Thank you. It's always a pleasure and it's a course to be here in Chicago. And if I could just continue the thought that Rabbi Rachmel so eloquently began, today is indeed Pesach Sheni, the gift of the second chance. But there's an additional observation that needs to be made. The genesis of the second chance was when people who were tamei, people who were impure, they came to Moshe and they said, why should we be excluded? Why should we not have a chance to participate? Mo didn't know what to do. He asked the Almighty, and the Almighty said, give them a chance a month later. The Chiddush Yerim, the first Ger Rebbe, raises the question, what would have been if they didn't ask? Would not Hashem have given this mitzvah? And the answer is no. God always gives second chances. But you have to ask. You have to want. You have to have the yearning. If one wants to become close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, at any age, under any circumstance, God will create the chance. But the door doesn't open until the person wants the door to be opened. And that is yet another lesson of Pesach Sheni. We're in the period of time between Pesach and Shavuos, which is called the counting of the Omer every single day. The Torah says that we count the days from the second day of Pesach, which represents freedom, till the day of Shavuos, which is the day that God gave us the Ten Commandments, the giving of the Torah. And when you contemplate Sfiras HaOmer, you see two opposite themes that ultimately converge and become one. Theme number one is, Sfiras HaOmer is a linkage between the holiday of freedom and the holiday of submission. It reminds us that freedom that is not rooted in submission to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is illusory, it is destructive, it is counterproductive, it is simply the liberation of the wild animal. Indeed, that's why Chazal say that the sacrifice of Passover, of Pesach, was a bodily sacrifice that is suitable for animals, and it is only on Shavuos, when we have the Torah, that we bring a wheat offering that is suitable for human consumption. It is a linkage and a reminder that freedom without commitment is worthless. It is even destructive, it is even negative. If I could draw on a non-Jewish source, the great Indian poet Tagore once remarked that a human soul is like a violin string. It is capable of expressing beautiful music. But paradoxically, if it's totally free, take a violin string, throw it on the table, it's totally unstretched, it's not confined in any way, it will not be able to produce a sound. Ironically, the music is produced only when it is stretched on a frame, and so too, we do not perceive of Torah as that which enslaves and that which confines. We conceive of Torah that which ultimately liberates, ultimately creates the flowering of the potentialities of the soul, in which a person has freedom, not in the negative sense of absence of restriction, but in the positive sense of being able to become what one was destined to become, that the beauty that is within a person can be realized in the fullness of their relationship to God. This is, we might say, theme number one of the counting of the Omer. The recognition that the meaning and benefit of freedom, of liberation, is only achieved by submission to the will of God. This was theme number one, and indeed, for many hundreds of years, this was the only theme of the counting of the Omer, or the primary theme. In later years, there's another aspect that we connect to the counting of the Omer, and that is, many of you know, that the counting of the Omer is a period of quasi-mourning, quasi-avelut. We don't get married during this period of time. We don't get haircuts or shaves. We don't listen to music. And there are many different customs. All of this period, part of this period, when do you start? We need not go into those technicalities. But nevertheless, this period, which logically and historically should have been joyous and filled with simcha in anticipation of the giving of the Torah, has become converted into somewhat of a sad, muted time, as our joy is not complete. According to Rav Chai Gaon, one of the greatest of the Gaonim, this is connected to the fact that the Gemara tells us that during this period of the Omer, 24,000 students of the great Rabbi Akiva died in a plague because they did not show proper honor and respect to each other. Now, there are many questions. The first question that might occur to somebody is, what's the big deal? I mean 24,000 people is certainly a tragedy. But in light of 6 million Jews who died during the Holocaust, in light of hundreds of thousands of Jews who died in pogroms and crusades, why should we specifically enact a mourning because of 24,000 students, a number which is numerically much, much less than those of the tragedies that happened later? And here, just to give a simple historical answer, the point to remember is that the entire tradition of the oral law was essentially coming from Rabbi Akiva to his students. All of his students were virtually decimated, except for 5 students. If those 5 would have gone as well, there literally would not have been a Torah to pass on to the next generation. Regardless of the numbers involved, the very survival of the Jewish people was hanging by the narrowest of threads in a way that was even greater in its magnitude than the Holocaust. But the second question that we think about is, the Talmud says they did not show kavod zeh lazeh. They did not show proper respect and honor to each other. And once again, we can assume that the students of Rabbi Akiva were very great, were great in learning. They certainly kept the mitzvahs. They didn't push each other in line or call each other names. That would be inconceivable. What does it mean that they did not show kavod zeh lazeh, that they did not show proper respect to each other? And another question. There's a well-known medrash where Rabbi Akiva himself taught V'ahavta l'reyecha kamocha, a pasuk in Leviticus, in Vayikra, to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Rabbi Akiva said, Zeh klal gadol b'Torah. This is a fundamental principle of the Torah. The relationship between love and respect and honor, kavod, is a very close relationship. The Vilna Gaon basically says, when we love another human being, what we love about them, if it is beyond the level of sexual infatuation, which is not really love but simply indulgence in one's lust, but when you love someone, you love the divine qualities that are within them. It might be their wisdom, it might be their kindness, it might be their humility. It might even be their sense of humor, because God has a sense of humor as well, in ways that we sometimes don't get. Dry humor, you might say. And therefore, all love is predicated on recognizing the qualities of the divine that are worthy of emulation and respect. If Rabbi Akiva taught that loving your fellow Jew is the fundamental principle of the Torah, and if love presupposes and is predicated on the fundamental respect that one has for their qualities. Indeed, it is so amazing that the students of Rabbi Akiva were somehow, on a level that we can't fully explain, deficient in that level of kavod. And let me point out, too, to bolster this point, Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch points out that the etymology of the word kavod comes from kaved, which is heaviness. Kavod is not treating people with respect externally. It is not etiquette. It is not Emily Post politeness. It is the recognition of the gravitas, the significance, in another person. It is direct, because you can treat somebody with all of the external politeness in the world, but you don't consider them to be worthy. You don't consider them as someone who can teach you something. You don't look at the qualities they have that are worthy of emulation. And thus Rav Hirsch points out, when the students of Rabbi Akiva were guilty of not showing kavod zeh lazeh, it was not so much in the externalities of behavior, but rather, since each of them had a great, wonderful Rebbe that they connected to, they felt less of a need to identify that which was unique and good in each other. And thus they were taken from the world, because they could not be the leaders and the inspiration of the Jewish people if they could not see the gravitas, the significance, the chashivas of another person. And thus, our Svarim tell us that what was going on during Sfiras HaOmer is not simply mourning a tragedy. If that would be bad, then maybe we ought to do for the Holocaust, for other tragedies. But rather, by recognizing the reason for this tragedy, we can resolve in our own lives to see the kavod in each other, to see the chashivas, to see the importance, to see the divine qualities within a person. And what is interesting is, what you see in life is what you get. When you see in another, and in yourself as well, those qualities of goodness, those qualities of kedusha, those elements of beauty which are reflections of the divine image under which every person is made, then those qualities will tend to become manifest. Every spouse knows that the more we show that we see the good in our spouse, the more that goodness is going to be manifest. Every parent knows, the more that we communicate that message to our child, that there's something good and special in you, the more good and special that child becomes. And that is exactly the way every human endeavor is. So, going back to the beginning of my remarks, if we ask ourselves, what are we supposed to do during the period of Sfiras HaOmer? There are two different things that we focus on, that in the polarized, dichotomized world that we live in, often exist in contradiction, though they shouldn't be in contradiction. On one hand, in preparation for Matan Torah, we should strengthen our commitment to learning Torah. We should strengthen our conscientiousness in keeping mitzvahs. We should become fiery and passionate in our avodas Hashem, to become true believers, to become zealous for the honor of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is service number one, avoda number one. But avoda number two is to cultivate within ourselves the qualities, to see within the other, even if they are less religious than we are in some way, to see their qualities of goodness, to learn to respect, to learn to focus on the positive within a human being, to see their kavod, to learn to love them. Because we cannot accept the Torah when there's dichotomy and machloket in Klal Yisrael. In the world that we live in, these two avodos often exist in a disharmonious contradiction. There tends to be a perversity of human nature, that as we become more firm in our beliefs, as we become more strong in our observances, as we become more convinced of fundamental truths, we tend to look at others who perhaps are not holding in the same place we are with a sense of disparagement, a sense of insignificance, a sense that they don't count. Conversely, when you meet Jews who you might call Big Tent Jews inclusionary Jews. I'm okay, you're okay. You often encounter a sense of moral relativism, situational ethics, people who don't stand for anything, because if all ideas are equally valid, then nothing is ultimately true. So, we live in a world, and again, I recognize I'm offering a caricature here, because there are, Baruch Hashem, many, many exceptions. But we live in a world, and again, if I could speak just in terms of broad generalities, where sometimes the more passionate people are about Torah, the less they can look at their fellow Jew with love, tolerance, and not just tolerance in the sense of I'll let him play his game, but genuinely striving to identify the good within a person. And then conversely, the more people are open to that tolerance and acceptance, the less firm they are in their own religious beliefs and commitments. Sviras HaOmer is teaching us that what we think of as contradiction in fact exists on a complementary basis. Indeed, become passionate, become strong, become firm, become fiery, and at the same time, gentle, loving, patient, forgiving, understanding. These can exist together. They must exist together. Because if it is true that the original Matan Torah could not be accomplished until the Jewish people were united, ki ish echad, like one person, ubelev echad, and one heart, so too, the Kabbalah Satorah, the receiving of the Torah that takes place every single year, can only be accomplished through doing whatever we can to create ish echad uvelev echad. And indeed, even if your goal, and this is a proper goal, is to bring fellow Jews to Torah, one of the complex dynamics of the outreach process is that people are not motivated to change for the better unless there is already a sense that they are already in a state of being okay. Because if the message that a person gets is, you're a garnished, you're a nothing, you're a worthless, that does not energize a person. Maybe logically perhaps it should, but psychologically, people are not motivated by a sense of their worthlessness. They are motivated by a sense of their goodness and their greatness. All change for the better comes when a person has a sense that they're fundamentally beloved in the eyes of God and in the eyes of those they care about. In fact, the Chassam Sofer says, going back to Rabbi Akiva, when Rabbi Akiva taught, V'yahavta l'reacha kamocha, loving your fellow neighbor as you love yourself, is a klal gadol, a fundamental principle in the Torah. The Chassam Sofer says Rabbi Akiva was actually offering an autobiographical insight. You know, we would not describe the Gemara, the Talmud, as a very romantic book, but one of the few extended romantic stories in the Talmud is the story of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was an ignorant shepherd. Rabbi Akiva was a person who said in his ignorance, and obviously he was endowed naturally as a very bright person, but he said that in the days of his ignorance, if he would have met a learned rabbi, he would want to bite that rabbi's bones like the way a donkey bites through a bone. Or rip him the way you rip a fish. He hated the rabbis. Probably because he felt, wrongfully so, but he felt they looked down upon him. And he was in the employ of a wealthy landowner, one of the wealthiest people in Yerushalayim. And lo and behold, the landowner's daughter wanted to marry Rabbi Akiva, this ignorant, coarse person. She saw something in him that perhaps Rabbi Akiva himself didn't know that he had. She saw qualities of greatness, qualities of devotion. And she urged him, at great sacrifice to herself, living in poverty, She sent her husband away to learn for 12 years in Yerushalayim, starting with the first graders learning the Aleph Beis. And when he came back after 12 years and he overheard her saying to somebody, I wouldn't mind if he'd learned for another 12 years, he went back right away, the story says, without even saying hello. And after 24 years, he was the great Rabbi Akiva, who came back with 24,000 students. Of course, the dimension becomes, the tragedy is that those were the 24,000 students who died in the Omer period. But Rabbi Akiva says, loving someone, which is defined as seeing the qualities of goodness within them, is a great principle in the Torah. The Chasam Sofer translates, is a great principle that brings people to Torah. Because we see those qualities that that very person didn't know that he had. But they were there all along. Somebody had to see them. Our job is to see those qualities. See those qualities in our spouses. See those qualities in our children. See those qualities in ourselves. Because then, and only then, will we and will they become that which Hashem intended that we and they become. In connection with that, the Balei Mitzvah used to say that if a person is not aware of their faults and their flaws, they are fools. We all have many, many faults and flaws. If a person is not aware of their own greatness, it's a tragedy. And at the Chazon Ish's Levaya, there was a yeshiva boy that was crying at the Chazon Ish's Levaya, 1954. And Rav Dessler, who was the mashgiach of the Panovich Yeshiva at the time, went over to the boy in the middle of the Chazon Ish's Levaya and said to the boy, why are you crying over the great rabbi and tzaddik who's buried in the ground? You should cry over the great rabbi and tzaddik that's buried within you. Because the rabbi and tzaddik who is buried in the ground became the rabbi and the tzaddik that he was supposed to become. But what about us? So Sviras HaOmer is a very, very important time, a very precious time. Because it reminds us on the most simple level not to focus on artificial dichotomies and polarizations. Do not let our commitments in one direction derail us from focusing on the other. Because ultimately these are two roads that we have to walk simultaneously. Because otherwise our Torah is defective, our Avodas Hashem is incomplete. Now I want to make two additional points, and again time is a little shorter than I would have liked, but once again I have a plane to catch by tomorrow, so, and we have other speakers too, so I'll have to be brief. You know, we recently, so this is Pesach Sheni, so forgive me to go backwards a month to Pesach, and we had a Seder, and all of you are familiar with the idea that after the first day of Pesach, or in the Golos, after the first 2 days of Pesach, we only say a half challah, we don't say a full challah. And although there are different reasons that are given, the most common reason that's given is that we are commiserating over the destruction of the Egyptians in the Red Sea. The Egyptians were drowning in the Red Sea, the angels wanted to sing a song of praise to God, and God said, do not sing to me right now. My creations, the Egyptians, are drowning in the sea. It is not a time for joy. And although we do express some joy because we were saved, but our joy is muted and restrained to some degree because we have commiseration, rachmanus, even for the destruction of the Egyptians. This is a very unique Jewish ritual. In the equivalent of the Palestinian Seder, rest assured that there is absolutely no such ritual that even conceivably could ever take place. But the question I want to raise with you, and again this is part of a much longer talk, is how come we become humanitarians, universalists, compassionate even towards our enemies. Only after the first night, during the Seder itself, we do, and on Yom Tov, we say the whole Hallel. We pour out the wine, to be sure, but we say the whole Hallel. Why do I become a universalist? Only when I focus on Kriyas Yom Tov. After all, the first night of Pesach was the plague of the firstborn. Egyptians died, and there were 10 plagues. Many Egyptians died. How come I don't have Rachmanis then? And one of the approaches is the following. Kriyas Yom Tov, the splitting of the Red Sea, was a greater revelation of God's love than any of the 10 plagues. And the reason is, if you think about it, in all of the 10 plagues, God did a miracle, but the miracle was to destroy the Egyptians, or to hurt the Egyptians. The miracle was not to benefit the Jew directly, it was to punish the Egyptians. The Jew benefited by advancing the redemptive process, to be sure, but the Shinoi HaTeva, the change of nature, was in the direction of punishment and paranas. As a result, the 10 plagues taught the Jews that God must be feared, God must be respected, you must have awe towards God, because He can change the whole natural order of the universe to punish and destroy wrongdoing. Kriyas Yom Tov was a miracle of pure love, because there, the miracle was the splitting of the sea. The Egyptians didn't die through a miracle. The Egyptians died by the natural collapse of water, once you don't have a miracle keeping apart. So the Beis Halevi explains, when the Jews walked away from the 10 plagues, they fully learnt the Midah of Yiras Hashem, fear and reverence for the Almighty. Kriyas Yom Tov taught them God's infinite love for them. And when they feel God's love for them, their hearts are filled with love for God. So here is the point. When you live a life where your relationship to God is based on the fear that you might get punished if you do something wrong, you live a life in which decisions are, and by the way, this is a very high madriga, but you live a life in which decisions are essentially made based on what's good for you. I'll do mitzvot because I'll get reward. I won't do aveiros because I don't want to get punished. When you live in terms of what is good or utilitarian for you, you really don't care if somebody else is suffering. So the first night of Pesach, which is a time of year, we don't care. Egyptians got hurt, so what? But here is the thing. If by Kriyas Yom Tov I feel God's love for me, and that arouses my love for God, part of love means you learn to see the universe from the perspective of the entity that you love. In a marriage, it's that way, right? Part of a relationship is you learn to see the world in part through the eyes of the other person. What's important to them becomes important to you. Well, when you love God, you see the world no longer through the prism of what's good for you. You learn, kavyachal, to whatever degree possible, to see the world from God's perspective. And from God's perspective, every human being is potentially precious. Every human being had something in him that could have been good. Every human being, even if they have to be destroyed, remember, God is not a pacifist. God destroyed the Rishayim. But it's a source of sadness and tragedy. So what you see from the Kriyas Yom Tov story is that love of God leads to love of man. Because the deeper one's love for God, the more you try to see the world from God's perspective. And from God's perspective, every human being is precious. Avas Hashem leads to Avas Yisrael, and to some degree even Ava for all human beings, as was the case of Mitzrayim. But let me point out that the association runs the other way as well. We read on Pesach Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs. Now the Song of Songs is written in highly romantic imagery, sexual imagery. It's written about a man and a woman. It's even a machlokes. Is it a two-character play or a three-character play? Because there's a reference to a shepherd and a reference to a king. And I'll peep shot. It's not clear if the shepherd and the king are one person or two people. And if you read Shir HaShirim literally, it does not seem appropriate for the Holy Tanakh. It is a sexual, romantic story. And as a result, in the Art Scroll translation of the Song of Songs, the permanent editorial board advised them that they should not translate it literally in the text, but rather it should be translated the way Chazal understood it, as an allegory, as a metaphor for the relationship that God has with the Jewish people. Right, God is the king, the Jewish people are the damsel, and everything in Shir HaShirim is a metaphor for that love, and that is why Shir HaShirim entered Tanakh. But, based on that idea, it doesn't read quite as well. So for example, if a pasuk says in Shir HaShirim, my lover ravishes me with kisses, the Art Scroll translation might say something like, when God took us out of Mitzrayim, he split the Red Sea for us. And the reader reads all that and says, well, okay, you know, it's not really adding too much to the Chumash, so to speak. I mean, we know this happened. And therefore, but again, they once again said that they were so determined that it should not be misunderstood, that they focused on the metaphorical meaning and not the literal meaning. But the question presents itself. Shlomo HaMelech was the wisest of all men. Why did he not heed the advice of the permanent editorial board? Why did he write something in the imagery that is so prone to be misunderstood and abused? And the answer to that was given by Rav Gifter Zatzal in a letter that in fact appears in the Art Scroll Shir HaShirim, although in Hebrew, untranslated. But the letter is there. And Rav Gifter said the following insight. Rav Gifter said, absolutely, Shir HaShirim is about the love that God has for the Jewish people and the love that the Jewish people have for God and the yearning and the desire on each side to be connected. And when we're ready, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says it's not the time, and when Hashem is ready for us, we're not ready. And the tragedies of missed opportunities and the glories and the joys of the past encounters where things were working out. But Rav Gifter says, Shlomo HaMelech wrote it in the form of a mashal, because if you can't understand the literal meaning of Shir HaShirim, you will not understand the metaphoric meaning. Until you learn, until we learn to truly love another human being, we will not be capable of loving God. As long as we are involved with our egotism, our selfishness, our agenda, our parochial concerns, we don't get beyond us, then how are we going to connect to God? And therefore, Shlomo HaMelech, you know, they tell a story about Leo Tolstoy, the great Russian novelist, who was also a count. And Tolstoy had serfs, even though he had written a number of treatises calling for the abolition of serfdom, because it was inconsistent with human dignity. And when Tolstoy was asked, why do you treat your serfs so bad? Tolstoy said, I am a lover of humanity. I just don't like people very much. Sometimes people are committed to abstractions, to global abstractions. I love God. I love Am Yisrael. I love the human race. I just don't get along with my next door neighbor or treat my wife or kids very well. But I love all people. Shlomo HaMelech is teaching us the opposite message. You want to love God, learn how to love a fellow human being in a deep way. So what you see is two interesting relationships that move in both directions. The thought of Kriyas Yamsuf teaches us that when we love God, we see the world from God's perspective, and that brings us to love of another human being. Shir HaShirim, we see the movement in the opposite way. By learning to love human beings, we go beyond our egotism, and then our heart becomes open to receive the presence of Hashem. So these are two factors that move in both directions, and both are essential for the avoda of Sfiras Omer. Just end with one final point. Everyone knows the famous story of Hillel. The non-Jew comes to Hillel and says, "Teach me the whole Torah on one foot." And Shammai chased him away, but Hillel says, "I'll teach you the whole Torah on one foot. And what I'll teach you is, what is hateful to you, do not do to another. Ve'idach, the rest of the Torah, Zeal Gemor, go and learn." Now, Christian scholars like to point out that Yeshka had a higher standard of morality than Hillel, because Hillel is an advocate of negative morality. You don't like to be hurt or humiliated? Don't do hurtful things to other people. But Yeshka had a higher level of morality, because he said, love your neighbor as you love yourself. It's not enough not to hurt somebody, but you also have to love them. Now, obviously everybody in this room, for no other reason than I said it earlier today, but I know you all knew it before anyway, knows what an absurdity that contention is. Because yes, Yeshka did indeed say, love your neighbor as you love yourself, but he was quoting a pasuk in the Chumash. Vayikra says, V'hafalecha kamocha. So to posit that the Torah does not endorse positive morality, but only negative morality, is obviously false. But the question then becomes a good question. Why does Hillel express the golden rule in the negative rather than in the positive? Isn't love more significant than simply not hurting? And the short answer would be, maybe not. Maybe not hurting is a lot higher than we think. Sometimes we look at human beings as vehicles through which we get our eternity in Olam Haba, as notches in our belt. Whether it's like we like to keep a record, a mental record of how many guests we have over for our houses for Shabbos. Oh good, you're the 150th person this year. Or how many people we were makarev, we made religious. I once saw an advertisement for tzedakah in which somebody, the organization was saying, you should regard a poor person who needs tzedakah like a lulav or an esrog through which you do a great mitzvah. Now, they were intending to emphasize how great the mitzvah is. But the Alter of Slobodka once said that that's a very, very destructive attitude. You don't look at people as objects through which you get your Olam Haba. Because when you look at them as objects, when you try to love them, when you try to do good for them, you will not necessarily be giving them what they need. You will not necessarily be stepping back and listening to who they are. You may not even be interested in knowing who they are. They're just empty vessels to pour in your righteousness and your mitzvahs. Hillel is teaching that before you start helping somebody, be sure you're not hurting them. Step back. Learn to know them. Learn to see them. Learn to respect them. And only when you know them in the fullness of their individuality are you then able to show the love that every person should receive. So the concept of Hillel, where you start off with the negative, is really the fundamental idea that in Avas Yisrael and in Chesed, we're not using people to give ourselves mitzvahs, but we have to strive to be genuinely concerned for who they are, where they are, where they're coming from. And if it is true in medical science that the first rule of all treatment is do no harm, it's equally true in the spiritual realm of Kiruv and Avas Yisrael. Do no harm. So these are things that we can think about, and be, and of course, again, as I say, I feel a little uneasy because obviously, as the Bali Musar used to say, but in this case it's absolutely true, I'm speaking to myself in terms of the Musar that I have to think about, and I hope it'll be helpful to all of us. And Be'ezras Hashem, if we create an atmosphere of love and respect and kavod, we will be truly roi and deserving of receiving HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah and Shavuos, ki ish echad, like one person, like one soul, ken yehi ratzon.